You are listening to 93.3 FM WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio. Coming up next, a show the NSA always loves to listen into and stop tapping my phones. This is The Mike Cannon Show.
Warning. The views expressed on The Mike Cannon Show, or the segments brought to you on this indie media radio show, do not necessarily reflect the views of WNRB nor WNRB's hosts.
Guess who's back again.
Mike Cannon.
This is my boomstick!
This could be dangerous. You should go back.
I know you're out there. I can feel it now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change.
Heads up. Welcome back to the McLaughlin Group, issue number one. With the controversy surrounding my calling Barack Obama an Oreo cookie, what snack food am I? A cheese puff, artificial and full of hot air? A vanilla wafer, white and crusty? Or a Twinkie, puffy and out of date? Wrong! The correct answer is lemon drop, bitter and sucky, bye-bye!
And now, the only radio commentator not addicted to illegal pain medication, nor Viagra, Mike Cannon.
Welcome back to this week's Indie Media Radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. Each and every week, we try to bring you alternative voices from around the country and the world. Voices the six mega corporations that control 90% of all television, newsprint, and radio do not want you to know about. The goal of the Mike Cannon Show is to offer these voices to you. It is obvious, if you ever listen to this show, that media just does not tell you the whole story, or even the truth for that matter. Our goal is to try to change that. The truth of the matter is that this is a project of love of mine that takes many, many hours to produce. This week in Radical History alone, I can spend up to 5 hours putting together. I'm not complaining, it's just that I feel that all these great shows out there deserve their own time and light too for all the efforts that they put into it. And getting the truth out beyond the big corporate filter is tough. So I dedicate this show to finding good, often great shows. My other hope is to offer this 3 to 4 hour show each week, up for rebroadcast on alternative stations who recognize the great material out there but don't have the time to put it all together themselves. This show tries to put it all in one place, so even if they don't air my show, they'll know what else is out there. That being said, I'm always open to suggestions. Consider dropping me a line at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Cannon is spelled C-A-N-N-O-N. That's all one long run-on word, themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. I'd like to take another moment out of my day here to talk a little more about what you can normally hear on the show. This show is produced for other not-for-profit community and micropower radio use. Some stations air part of my show. Other stations may or may not know what I normally offer. I'd like to mention some of those shows here. The first hour normally always includes a great weekly roundup of news items from the previous week from the great work done at the people at Eat the State. I also try to include two pieces I produced, This Week in Radical History and a shorter This Week Serac Body Count. I also try to include in the first hour Women's E-News information about women's concerns and other short pieces I can fit into the first hour of the show. The second hour always starts out with an LGBT news advocacy magazine called This Way Out. I'll then try to fit in some shorter great material that could not fit in the first hour, like Peak Oil Check-In, Ask Mr. Green, that type of eco-news programming. Also, shorter radio spin and media minutes is included in the first or second hour, depending upon where I could fit it in. The third hour will feature This Week in Palestine, giving the listeners a chance to hear some news reports produced out of Palestine from a non-Zionist, non-corporate point of view. Also included in the third hour is often World Report and or Scooter and his Interside Radio programming, which offers a little humor later in the show. I also feel it necessary, especially for us Wisconsin listeners, to hear what Canada is doing and saying, being that they're only a couple hundred miles away from our border, and we probably have more affinity with Canada than we do from people, let's say, like Texas or Florida, for that matter. And often when I air World Report, it is a surprise how much news is about the United States. This week's World Report show talks a lot about U.S. war resisters living in Canada, something never talked about on the Lower 48 media. Again, the corporate-slash-government-influenced media just will not cover that subject. However, it's obviously a mainstay in Canadian news. So that is a typical lineup you get each week on the Mike Cannon Show. Often, unless I have something very spectacular or I have a lot of time on my hands, which is very seldom since it takes quite a long time to produce this show, I will loop the first hour and the fourth hour of my show. So if you're listening on WNRB LP in Wausau, Wisconsin, This week, as in most weeks, you can expect to hear the first hour of the show again repeated on the fourth hour. Again, I am always curious if anyone has any suggestions about how to make the show better. And please feel free to contact me if you do at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. So let's get back into this week's show. The normal fare, the normal lineup I mentioned earlier that you get to hear this week. I hope you enjoy this little effort to get news the corporations do not cover, and to introduce to you nonprofit, often community radio stations at its best. And as always, I'd like to thank you for listening.
Thanks for that introduction, guys. They didn't mention that I stood fifth from the bottom of my class at the Naval Academy. If my old company officer were here today, he would tell you that in America anything is possible.
It's a history major. C student. There's hope for you, C students. There's hope for you. I've seen how things can work out pretty well for a C student.
The fact is that I have agreed with President Bush far more than I have disagreed. And on the transcendent issues, the most important issues of our day, I have been totally in agreement and support of President Bush.
There's an old saying in Tennessee, I know it's in Texas, probably in Tennessee, that says, fool me once, shame on you. If fool me, we can't get fooled again. I was a C student. I want you to take note of who's the president and who's the advisor. He's got the PhD and the medical degree, and I'm the C student. Notice who's the advisor and who's the president.
We know that the President Bush was a C student at Yale. So do you remember your GPA at school?
My GPA earned me fifth from the bottom of my class at the Naval Academy status. So the GPA was based, since that was in the Coolidge administration, was a different measurement, but I can assure you on today's standards it would be barely passing.
It fooled me, we can't get fooled again.
Sit back, relax, breathe in. Slowly, there you go. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
Women's E-News, weekly summary of news about women, women's issues, and from women's perspectives. From the weekly Cheers and Jeers column of July 12, 2008. I'm Sandy Billings. Leading with good news, cheers for winners of the Gruber Women's Rights Prize. Three prominent women's rights activists will share the $500,000 Gruber Women's Rights Prize from the Peter and Patricia Gruber Foundation. Yanar Mohammed, co-founder of the Organization for Women's Freedom in Iraq, has opened shelters and safe houses for women threatened by domestic abuse and so-called honor killings from their families. She is also publisher of Al-Mosawat, the only Iraqi print publication that calls for full equality for women. Sapana Prada Mala, a lawyer and president of the Forum for Women, Law, and Development, fights for legal reforms to protect women's reproductive rights in Nepal. Mala helped initiate legislation to criminalize rape in the country. Nader Shalab Kevorkian, a Palestinian feminist scholar, therapist, and activist, has worked to end violence against Palestinian women, especially honor killings. She has trained female activists in the West Bank and Gaza, where she also established a hotline for reporting abuse. More news to cheer this week. The governing body of the Anglican Church in Britain approved the consecration of women as bishops on July 7th. The decision was not billed as final. Church legislation to implement the change is to be debated next year, and the Church of England officials say a female bishop will most likely not be consecrated before the year 2014. India's lesbian and gay rights movement had its first large public parade display May 29th in New Delhi, Kolkata, and Bangalore. Indian activists are fighting to reform a 19th century law that bans homosexuality. New York Governor David A. Patterson said he will sign into law a change in the state's domestic violence law that will permit everyone in dating relationships, including same-sex couples, to seek civil protection orders from abuse in family courts. Currently, the state's domestic violence law allows protective orders only from spouses and former spouses, blood relatives, or the other parent of an abused person's child. Henry Morgenthaler, a leading abortion rights activist, received the Order of Canada for his contributions to the country. Morgenthaler, now aged 85, opened Canada's first abortion clinic in 1969. And now for the bad news of the week, jeers for lack of leadership on women's issues from the G8. Women's issues failed to climb to the top of the agenda of the Group of Eight Global Summit this week. The group is composed of the eight wealthiest nations. The G8 met in Japan to address the world food crisis, but the status of women was not a focus, despite an acknowledged inability to meet the United Nations Millennium Development Goals to improve women's health and reduce poverty before the 2015 target date. The New York-based international women's rights organization, MADRE, called on world leaders to recognize gender discrimination as a threat to global food security. The organization noted women are the majority of the world's farmers, growing and processing 80% of all food, but are often denied the right to own land and are excluded from government programs. More news to jeer this week. Domestic workers in Saudi Arabia are subject to serious human rights abuses. They experience months or years of unpaid wages, forced imprisonment, physical and sexual abuse, and lashings for false charges of theft, adultery, or witchcraft. This, according to a report from the Human Rights Watch. Saudi households employ approximately 1.5 million domestic workers, mainly from Indonesia, Sri Lanka, the Philippines, and Nepal. The report is based on 142 interviews with domestic workers, senior government officials, and labor recruiters in Saudi Arabia. In Cambodia, Mu Songcha, a woman running as an opposition candidate for parliament, said she was assaulted by an army general on June 30th, and she accused the government of violating fair campaign rules by allowing the military to support government candidates and interfere in campaign activities. An activist group also said a local official attempted to run over Mu Songcha with his motorcycle, then repeated his threats over Radio Free Asia. Jenny Williams and Magodongo Malangu of the human rights activist group Women and Men of Zimbabwe Arise were arrested in the capital Harare and have been in jail since May 28. They were charged with disturbing the peace and publishing statements prejudicial to the state. In a political crackdown stemming from President Robert Mugabe's disputed victory in the June 27th election, about 900 camps set up by his party are detaining women and girls and keeping them as sex slaves. Presidential candidate John McCain misrepresented his position on equal pay on the campaign trail, according to Americans United for Change. The advocacy group said McCain told an audience at a Hudson, Wisconsin town hall meeting that he was, quote, committed to making sure that there's equal pay for equal work, unquote. But the group points out that the senator from Arizona publicly criticized the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act and was absent from Congress when the bill came up for a vote. U.S. women earn 77 cents for each dollar a man earns. Golf for Women magazine will cease publication in August since it is struggling to attract advertising. The magazine has a circulation of 600,000 and was purchased by Condé Nast in 2001. The conglomerate has also shuttered Sports Illustrated for Women and Women's Sports and Fitness magazines. In memoriam, on July 9th, family and friends held a service in Lawrence, Kansas for 25-year-old Jana McKay. McKay was a second-year law student and a women's rights activist and was known for her support of sexual assault survivors. She was also involved with the National Organization for Women and lobbied for a pro-choice political action committee in Kansas. Her ex-boyfriend, Adolfo Garcia Nunez, was arrested on July 4th in Elizabeth, New Jersey, and charged with her homicide, but died in his jail cell from an apparent suicide. These news briefs were compiled by Besa Lucci. Rita Henley Jensen is the editor-in-chief. This production of Women's E-News is brought to you by VP Foundation and Yen Radio. Background music is by Joan Hickey. This column and more news about women can be found at the Women's E-News website, www.womensenews.org. For Yin Radio, I'm Sandy Billings.
Heads up!
You can't arrest me. I'm the President of the United States.
You're not the President. You're Josh Brolin. You're just playing George Bush in a movie.
I lied us into war, authorized torture, warrantlessly spied on Americans, and I get arrested for this? A bar fight?
Man, you're really into character.
I don't have to follow no law. I am the law. I'm gonna write a signing statement saying bar fights are legal. Call Cheney. Get me out of here. Oh, but don't tell Laura I'm drinking again.
Method actors.
And now, Xbox Magazine's Nerd of the Year, Mike Cannon.
Up next, a short summary of national world news events from last week from the folks at Eat the State.
Moving on to national and the Fourth Circuit Court in Virginia.
Yeah, this by far the most conservative of the various circuit court of appeals had a 5-4 ruling this week that was very disturbing in its implications. It upheld the indefinite detention of U.S. citizens as enemy combatants. Now, it was reported in many media accounts as a mixed decision because it also said that those citizens, if they were named as enemy combatants by the President of the United States, they could be detained indefinitely or they could be imprisoned indefinitely. Let's not use the euphemism of detainees anymore, shall we? But they did have to have due process. But what exactly does due process mean? In this case, the defendant is a guy named Ali Al-Mari. He's a legal U.S. resident from Qatar. He's been held since the Muslim sweeps post 9/11 in 2001, was charged in 2002 with credit card fraud, and in 2003 was named an enemy combatant based on second and third hand torture-induced accounts by somebody somewhere. The government still has not said where. The claim that Al-Mari was came to the United States to be part of an Al-Qaeda sleeper cell. Well, the definition of a sleeper cell is that his big offense was that he slept. In other words, he didn't do anything. So what does it mean to have due process when, as we've talked about on this program before, one of the whole points of torture isn't that it induces bad information to be elicited from prisoners, but the whole point is that you can get them to tell you what you want them to tell you, and therefore you then have a narrative that fits with your preconceived idea of what you want to have. In other words, if you want somebody to testify that this guy is a bad actor, you can get anybody to testify that this guy's a bad actor. You just torture them enough. So what does it mean to have due process saying that you go to a court and say, yes, we've got a witness, we can't produce the witness, we can't name exactly what the witness said, but we can assure you that in fact this guy is a bad actor, and the court says okay and signs off on it. That is not due process. There was also no time window that was specified on this. So a very, very troubling decision. It means that, for example, President Obama could come in and say that you, Maria, you are an enemy combatant because you didn't vote for President Obama, and therefore you can be whisked off and held indefinitely in a military brig somewhere without trial.
Yeah.
All right, moving on, this week's economic news.
Yeah, there were two big things in the economic news this week. First was the collapse of IndyMac Bank, a Southern California regional bank that was seized by the feds last Friday after customers made a run on the bank trying to withdraw their money. This is the largest bank failure since the SNL scandal in the 1980s. It's the third biggest bank failure in U.S. history. The only two larger ones were in the 1980s during the SNL scandal. The FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, will have to cough up between $4 to $8 billion in order to cover depositors' assets, and that still leaves about 20,000 people who will lose at least part of what they deposited in the bank. This was also the interesting thing about IndyMac is that it was the ninth largest mortgage lender in the U.S. with some $32 billion of assets. So even with that kind of capitalization, this bank was not too big to fail. And it really sort of asks the question, what is too big to fail? What is small enough that the feds will just let it go under? And what does that mean for consumers, for people who have their money deposited in not big banks, but smaller regional banks? And can we really know what is a big versus a small bank when a company like Washington Mutual, for example, is national in the sense that it's the third largest mortgage lending company in America, and yet it's regional in that its commercial deposits and its private banking is not as nearly as large as its mortgage lending unit. So it leaves people who have deposits at Washington Mutual wondering, could the same thing happen to them? Well, we don't really know, do we? Because there's not nearly enough transparency in the financial sector. Well, this question of what is too big to fail is interesting because it hits on the other big economic news this week, which was the Fed propping up Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, basically giving them a bailout, saying, okay, here's $300 billion that you can draw on to avoid going under. Because this past week, shares of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac fell by almost 50%. And the problem with letting companies as big as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac go under is that these are truly mammoth banks. And they really are key in not just the U.S. financial industry, but the global financial industry. Before Congress approved the expansion of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to pretty much take over mortgage lending, because now they constitute something like 98% of the market for mortgage lending in the U.S. now, as of March, from about March to June. But Congress had to approve an expansion allowing them to borrow more in order to lend more. Well, to borrow more, they had to go to other banks to borrow the money, which means they owe money to all these other banks, not just in the U.S., but all over the world, particularly Asian banks who saw Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac as a very safe investment. Well, it's Asia that global economists are looking to help bail us out of our current problem. Well, Asian banks are suffering too now. So really, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are too big to let them go under. But it really points at how bad the whole problem is if here at the start of the credit crisis, we're seeing this happen now.
Yeah, it's going to get worse before it gets better.
All right, just a couple minutes left. Moving on to international and Iran.
Yeah, some positive developments for a change this past week or two in negotiations with Iran over its nuclear program, the 5+1 negotiations. There was a secret letter that was drafted on June 14th in which the U.S. Expressed its willingness for the first time to negotiate around uranium enrichment and some of the other issues directly with Iran. Now came the announcement this week that Nicholas Burns, who testified last week before Congress that he was going to work very hard toward a diplomatic solution. Some people took that as a positive sign. Other people thought, well, the Bush administration has made paid lip service to diplomacy before. Well, he is actually going to participate in the talks for the first time. The Bush administration will actually sit down and talk with Iran on the nuclear issue. That cannot help but be a positive development.
All right. And Iraq.
Yeah, we saw a bunch of reports this morning that both al-Maliki's government in Baghdad and the United States in the White House had reported that the security agreement that's being negotiated between the two governments had agreed in principle to something called a time horizon rather than the troop withdrawal deadline that the Iraqis had demanded. Now, this is being spun by the Washington Post and New York Times this morning as major shift for the Bush administration. They've agreed to a timeline for withdrawal. Not hardly. It's giving both sides something that they can point to and claim they got what they wanted. The Iraqi government is saying, well, the Bush administration agreed to something. The Bush administration can say, well, we didn't agree to a timeline for withdrawal, and it's not clear what either side of them means, but the critics within Iraq and the critics of the war are still going to be saying, look, this doesn't actually commit the Bush administration or the successor government, whether it's Obama or McCain, to actually doing anything in terms of withdrawing troops from Iraq.
The last few weeks have seen a momentous development in Iraq. According to the Washington Post, the Bush administration's ham-handed attempt at securing legal authorization for a long-term occupation of Iraq through negotiating a status of forces agreement with the Iraqi government has collapsed, and the best that they hope for now is a bridge agreement that passes the buck to Bush's successor. And it has collapsed in the end because of resistance by the Iraqi government. The story is an interesting one. First, SOFA negotiations started to create something Iraq has not seen since its shambolic attempt at creating multi-party democracy started, the incipient creation of a non-sectarian opposition united around Iraqi nationalism. For once, the split was not Sunni versus Shia or Arab versus Kurd, but rather parties and lawmakers of all groups who perceived themselves to be on the outside of the government versus those on the inside. Then, debate in the Iraqi National Assembly was hot enough that Nouri al-Maliki had to agree to submit any draft agreement to full discussion and vote by the parliament, something George Bush, confronted with a remarkably supine Democrat-controlled Congress holding its breath until January 20th, was not ready to permit over here in the birthplace of democracy. This agreement, coupled with Ayatollah Sistani's obvious disgust with the Shia parties now controlling the government, that's how I interpret his dictum later agreed on by the Electoral Commission that his picture not be used in upcoming elections, has created a major concern among those parties about their showing in upcoming provincial elections, especially since the Sadrists, who are not planning to contest those elections as a party, but will as individuals, can quite convincingly lay claim to the banner of nationalism. In the end, Nouri al-Maliki said that no agreement would be ratified if it did not include a timetable for withdrawal. The Bush administration tried to suggest to him to change his tune, hinting that perhaps his words had been mistranscribed or mistranslated, but he held firm and the SOFA was dead. The ridiculous overreach involved in actually wanting Iraqi lawmakers to meekly ratify the sort of brazen extraterritoriality agreements that one usually associates with China's domination by Western powers in the late 19th century certainly helped. In fact, in the ongoing negotiations, the administration was forced to scale back or abandon those demands, especially with regard to private contractors. But, I guess, was not the primary consideration. Nationalism, particularly the nationalism of the oppressed, often latches on to symbolism over substance. In 1905, the British partition of Bengal, unlike later partitions a purely administrative move that hardly affected the lives of Indians, ignited the first mass political protests of the freedom movement. The crushing taxes levied by the British, the policies that created mass starvation by famine in the late 19th century, did not have the same galvanizing effect. One of the biggest mistakes the United States made, in May 2003, was to call what they were doing an occupation. The word Ihtilal is not only the word used for the Israeli occupation, but also quite clearly indicates national subordination. This time, though that word was not used, it's been on everyone's mind for 5 years. Everyone from local imams to Hashemi Rafsanjani of Iran has been warning that the agreement means, quote, eternal servitude. The last time Iraq saw a political revolt of this magnitude was in April 2004 during the first assault on Fallujah, before there even was a parliament. All that has intervened since, including the brutal second assault on Fallujah, the severe U.S. mistakes that led to the ignition of sectarian civil war, Haditha, Mahmoudia, Nisour Square, couldn't quite serve as foci for legislative resistance in the way that this particular form of words being pushed by the Bush administration did. Though there's certainly no doubt that the improving condition of Iraq also is what has given al-Maliki and the government the confidence for such acts. This is not the first time the Iraqi parliament has refused to give the Bush administration the legislation it wants. Its defeat of the U.S. push for an oil law that granted unnecessary favors to foreign oil companies last fall was fairly important as well. The difference is that this one is foundational, striking at the occupation itself, which is the precondition for enforcing any other agreements. The emergence of this kind of democratic resistance to U.S. demands in favor of the Iraqi national interest bodes well for that benighted country and for us. How the United States reacts to it is of paramount importance. For Empire Notes, this is Rahul Mahajan.
You are listening to 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free People, Free Radio.
It's 3 a.m. and your children are safe and asleep. But there's a phone in the White House and it's ringing. Something's happening in the world.
Hello.
Sir, this is General Johnson calling.
Go ahead.
I'm terribly sorry to wake you up at this late hour, but we've got a developing situation in Iraqistan, and I want to link you into our Rapid Response Live update stream. Shall I email you instructions for a Mac or a PC?
I gotta give you some straight talk. Neither. I am an illiterate that has to rely on my wife for all of the assistance that I can get.
But, sir, your wife is traveling overseas. Surely you can figure this out yourself.
I can barely get the news clips that have my name on them.
It's 3 a.m., and your children are safe and asleep. Who do you want?
You are listening to a radio. Because of the time it takes for radio to travel to Earth from distant sources, radio astronomers are able to see the universe as it appeared more than 10 billion years ago. The artificial radio broadcast you are listening to now portrays the universe as it was just 1 second ago. Stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
Poor people gonna rise up and take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talk about a revolution.
This Week in Radical History for the week of July 21st. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer. Some audio was borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York. And more radical info can be found on the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This Week in Radical History, starting July 21st, 1916, U.S. Marines land in Haiti again to protect American interests. They'll go back again and again as well, the U.S. having a lot of interest to protect.
The men and women in our armed forces protect our borders and our people. Not the financial interests of Folgers, Chiquita Banana, Exxon, and Halliburton. These are not isolated incidents of stupidity. They're part of a long, bloody history of foreign policy being conducted for the financial interests of the wealthy few.
Also on July 21st, 1954, the Geneva Accords are signed, ending the French colonization of French Indochina, a place also known as Vietnam. The U.S. discovering that the French might not be interested, but by God, the U.S. must have some special interest in Vietnam. Within a year, they'll have her first military advisor setting the stage for the Vietnam War. Also on July 1st, 1972, George Carlin is charged with disorderly conduct for performing his famous Seven Words Act in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
There are two things that I blame for the abysmal condition of this magnificent species that had such potential at one time, and that is religion and commerce. And those are the two things that hinder us here. I mean, the religious people say this is immoral, it is corrupting, and it will do bad things to your character if you even hear these words as a child or a grown-up or whatever. And commerce says if you say these things, the customers and the advertisers are going to run from you.
This Week in Radical History for July 22nd.
On this day, July 22nd, in 1863, American frontiersman Kit Carson was ordered by the military governor of New Mexico to get rid of the entire Navajo Nation. At first, Carson was shocked by the brutal nature of this plan and attempted to resign his position, but after being pressured to stay, he obediently began the forced removal of the Navajo people from their land. First, Carson and his men implemented a scorched earth policy, burning Navajo fields and homes and stealing their livestock. Carson then began attacking the Navajo strongholds that fought in resistance until the Navajo were forced to surrender. A few months later, 8,000 Navajos were forced to march 300 miles to Fort Sumner, where they were imprisoned for the next 4 years. Over 300 people died during the long walk, and many more died in imprisonment. This is just one of the many brutal atrocities committed against indigenous populations in the land of the free.
Also on July 22, 1938, Joe Louis defeats German boxer Max Schmeling. Because of the Nazi persecution of the Jews in Europe and Hitler's disdain for blacks, the fight had a mystic proportions, with Louis seen by many as fighting to uphold democracy and the race. He succeeded convincingly, ending the fight in the first round. Also on July 22, 1970, during the Alcatraz occupation by Indians of all tribes, the first child was born on the first freed Native American piece of land in the 20th century. Also on this date in 1995 in Israel, four foreign activists break padlocks and reopen the main gates to the Palestinian Hebron University in the West Bank, closed by Israeli security and occupation forces back in 1987.
On this day, July 23rd, in 1846, writer and philosopher Henry David Thoreau was thrown in jail for refusing to pay his $1 poll tax in protest of American slavery in the Mexican-American War. Thoreau had resisted his poll tax for 6 years because he did not support the government's use of the money. Although he was only in jail for one night, the experience deeply impacted him, and he began speaking out about the responsibility of individuals to hold their government accountable. 3 years later, Thoreau wrote Civil Disobedience, an essay explaining how the actions of the American government were controlled by only a few individuals rather than the people. Thoreau's essay was highly influential to many activists.
Also on this day, July 23rd, 1892, strikers battle Pinkerton thugs during the Carnegie Steel Strike in Homestead, Pennsylvania, as the Pinkertons, trying to import and protect scabs, open fire on striking steel workers. In the ensuing battle, three Pinkertons and 11 strikers and spectators are shot dead. Strikers militantly resisted the private goons hired by Henry Clay Frick to dislodge them from the plant grounds. They fought back with guns and homemade cannon. The strike, however, lasted for 4 months, but the company was able to restore production as winter approached and morale declined. Anarchist Alexander Berkman, on this day, would enter Frick's office and shoot him, trying to revenge the deaths of the strikers. As a side note, later in the year, Emma Goldman would horsewhip her old mentor, Johann Maust, for shit-talking Berkman's attempt. She horsewhipped him on stage and broke the whip afterwards. Also on July 23, 1908, Nazi sympathizer and anti-Semite Henry Ford would sell his first Model T. On July 30, 1938, Hitler presented the highest non-citizen award, Grand Cross the Supreme Order of the German Eagle, to Henry Ford in Berlin. U.S. Senate reports in 1974 on Ford Motor Company's aid to Nazi war effort. Have you driven your Ford in support of the Nazis lately? Also on July 23, 1967, starts out of Detroit upheavals, 7 days of social unrest, fighting with cops, anti-business, anti-government actions, including looting, results in 43 dead, 2,000 wounded, and 5,000 made homeless. Largest U.S. riots in a century, sparks additional riots throughout the United States. Also on this date in 1968, police kill 7 in standoff with black nationalists in Cleveland, Ohio, triggering days of riots and 4 more deaths. Lastly, on July 23, 2004, preemptive harassment as FBI and Joint Terrorism Task Force investigate info shops and anarchists throughout the country. In Lawrence, Columbia, Kirksville, Topeka, and St. Louis, agents served several anarchists with subpoenas, ordering them to report to the grand jury on the same day they were planning to go to Boston to protest the Democratic National Convention. Let freedom ring. This day in radical history for July 24th, labor organizer Mary Harris Mother Jones begins the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Theodore Roosevelt Summer Hole in Oyster Bay, Long Island, New York, to publicize the harsh conditions of child labor in Philadelphia textile mills. When Mother Jones first visited Philadelphia, she found child workers as young as 10-year-old with stooped shoulders and missing fingers and hands. In response, she organized the march. Mary Harris Mother Jones led striking children from Kennington Textile Mills in Pennsylvania on a 17-day march from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, where they hoped to confront Roosevelt in his summer home. About 300 men, women, and children were led by 3 children dressed as Revolutionary War soldiers. Along the way, they raised awareness of child laborers with rallies in eastern Pennsylvania, New York, and New Jersey, and won the hearts of many. When Mother Jones and her army arrived in Coney Island, she was asked to speak. The result of the speech was The Wail of the Children, which was delivered today. When they reached Oyster Bay on July 29th, where Teddy Roosevelt was vacationing, he refused to see them. Our beloved Teddy Roosevelt would be quoted as saying, "The worst foe of the poor man is labor leaders, who tries to teach him that he is the victim of conspiracy and injustice." Of course, the children would have problems reading these reports in the newspapers, since they're often kept illiterate and had no fingers for turning the pages. Also on this day, July 24th, 1925, John T. Scopes, convicted in Tennessee of teaching evolution in high school, fined $100 and costs for monkeying around. Also on this date in 1950, German V-2 became the first rocket to be launched at Cape Canaveral, Florida. Big surprise, as the U.S. provided safe haven for thousands of Nazis following World War II, including known war criminals and hundreds of scientists who developed the Nazi-German rocket program. In the U.S. intelligence, there is no prohibition for hiring anyone in the Gestapo or SS, historians said. This was a don't ask, don't tell culture. Also on this date in 1974, House Judicial Committee debates Nixon's articles of impeachment, including obstruction of justice, abuse of presidential powers, using CIA, FBI, and IRS and other federal agencies to violate civilian constitutional rights and to create the Plumbers Group to engage in illegal acts, as well as failure to supply subpoenaed material to the committee. Failure to turn over subpoenaed materials. Same crimes, different times. Lastly, on this date in 1983, women tag U.S. warplanes with graffiti at Greenham Commons in England. This week in Radical History for July 25th, 1648 in New World, York County Court upholds authority of colonists to kill on site any free Indians they see in settled areas. Also on July 25th, 1930, a white mob threatens to hang ranchers employing Filipinos in Washington, Filipinos being the Mexican of their time, or the Irish before them, or the Polish before them, or the Chinese before them. Just pick your wave of immigrants you vilify and marginalize. Also 1946, the crime, two young black couples are killed by a lynch mob at Moore's Ford Bridge over the Apache River. The four were tied up and shot hundreds of times in broad daylight by unmasked men. Murder weapons included rifles, shotguns, pistols, and machine guns. The Tuskegee Institute newspaper called it a lynching. The cover-up. Despite the intense investigation by the FBI, the killers remain free. The best people in town won't talk, says Georgia State Patrol officer, on the climate of fear and threat of retaliation that discourages law-abiding citizens to cooperate with the investigation. Again, in 2005, there was another attempt to bring the survivors of the mob to justice, but that failed as well. No justice, no peace. Also on this date in 1969, proving how everyone is equal in the United States, Senator Edward M. Kennedy drives a car in which Mary Jo Capaci is killed earlier in the week, receives a 2-month suspended sentence for leaving the scene of an accident, however nothing for killing Mary Jo.
On this day, July 25th in 1972, the Washington Star exposed the story of the Tuskegee Syphilis Experiment, a cruel medical study that the U.S. Public Health Service had been conducting on 399 poor black men for the last 40 years. The men who were in the late stages of syphilis and lacked access to proper health care were not in a position to deny this supposedly free treatment. They were never told that they had syphilis and were actually left untreated while slowly dying from the degenerative disease. The experiment had continued despite the World Health Organization's 1964 declaration that informed consent was mandatory for experiments involving human beings.
Also on this date, 1983 in Nicaragua, the American right-wing funded Contras torture and kill 15 at San Francisco del Norte. Reagan compares the Contras to the nobility of Abraham Lincoln. Also on this date in 1990, U.S. Ambassador Applegate tells Iraq President Hussein that the U.S. won't take sides in Iraq-Kuwait dispute, or perhaps it will invade and start the first Gulf War. It's one or the other. Also on this date in 1993, Lebanon. Israeli begins blasting targets in southern Lebanon. 130 die by the end of the month. 500,000 civilians flee the bombardment. Tune in again in 2006 as Israel and Hezbollah go at it. Lastly on this date, in 2001, Bush administration, high on image, short on principle, rejects the draft treaty on enforcement of biological weapons ban. Saddam can't have them, but we sure can. This week in Radical History for July 26, 1860, Norton I declares the United States dissolved, turns over temporary powers to state governors, and declares himself emperor. This one-time very rich land speculator living in San Francisco even issues the Imperial of Norton Treasury notes from 50 cents to $20 denominations. Also on this date in 1874, the U.S. orders friendly Indians are to remain in fixed camps in Wichita Agency, Oklahoma Indian Territory, and answer periodic roll calls to stop any possibility of them moving around freely. Also on this date in 1877, 30 workers killed at the Battle of Viaduct by federal troops in Chicago. The Battle of Viaduct, U.S. troops and 2nd Militia Regiments and police attack about 5,000 workers at Halstead and 16th Street in Chicago, Turner Hall raid. Police raid the hall during the meeting of the German furniture maker, killing one and wounding many. A judge later finds that the police are guilty of preventing the workers from exercising their right of freedom of speech and assembly. A grim reminder that the true function of police in the Army is not issuing traffic tickets, paying officer-friendly, or defending the shores of terrorism, but keeping its own citizens in line and the nation workers docile in the need of political and business powers that be. That editorial from the Daily Bleed website. Also on July 26, 1909, during the week of July 26 through August 1st, Barcelona presented a spectacular and full-scale insurrection, a largely spontaneous uprising with little guidance from Union and radical leaders. As reported in the London newspaper, what was happening here was amazing. A social revolution had broken out in Barcelona, and it had been started by the people. No one had instigated it. No one led it. Neither the liberals, nor the Catalonian nationalists, nor the republicans, nor the socialists, nor the anarchists. This, of course, would be a prelude to the Spanish Civil War. For on this date in 1936, the attempted fascist takeover of Spain begins, flattering Adolf Hitler agrees to provide aid to the fascist government. 4 days hence, Germany and Italy provides planes to airlift fascist troops from Africa to Spain. Of course, the United States, France, and England refuse to aid the people fighting the fascists. Also on July 26, 1947, National Security Act consolidates Armed Forces' newly created Department of Defense, replacing the War Department. It further establishes the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, and the National Security Agency, NSA, and numerous other secret black budget government agencies outside public review and control. This marks what some argue is the beginning of the American global empire building and the end of the American Republic, with its gutting of the Constitution and the slide towards an American police state.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, July 26, in 1953, Cuban revolutionaries Fidel and Raúl Castro led an unsuccessful attack on the Moncada barracks in Santiago de Cuba. The attack was an attempt to overthrow Cuban President Batista, who consistently protected U.S. interests at the expense of the Cuban people. Upon his release from prison, Castro joined forces with Che Guevara in Mexico and organized the 26th of July movement to liberate Cuba. After peaceful resistance tactics failed, Castro and Che resorted to armed guerrilla warfare, successfully overthrowing Batista in 1959.
One last item for July 26, 1967. Three black men were killed and 9 others brutally beaten in what was known as the Algerian Motel Incident. Detroit police, Michigan State Troopers, National Guardsmen, and private guards who had been directed to the scene, responding to a telephone report of a sniping, the police group invaded the Algiers Motel and interrogated 10 black men and 2 white women, none of whom were armed, for an hour. By the time the interrogators left, 3 men had been shot to death and others, including the women, beaten. The resulting Detroit riots included 40 deaths, 2,000 injuries, and 5,000 left homeless, involving more than 4,700 federal paratroopers and 8,000 National Guardsmen to quell the disturbance after this gross injustice at the hotel. This week in radical history for July 27, 1869, William Silvis dies, head of the National Labor Union, the first such organization in U.S. history. Is quoted as saying, "Capital blights and withers all it touches. It is a new aristocracy. Proud, imperious, dishonest, seeking only profit and the exploitation of workers." Also on this date in 1918 in Canada, United Mine Workers organizer Ginger Goodwin is shot by hired private cops outside Cumberland, British Columbia. His murder sparks Canadians' first general strike. His remains are buried in the Cumberland Cemetery nearby. A section of the island highway was named Ginger Goodwin Way. He won't be forgotten. The rough sandstone marker on his grave says, "Lest we forget, Ginger Goodwin shot July 27, 1918, a worker's friend."
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, July 27th, the Chicago Race Riot of 1919 began, lasting 5 days and claiming the lives of 23 blacks and 15 whites. The riot was sparked when a black teenager named Eugene Williams drowned after a group of white men pelted him with rocks when he drifted into the all-white section of a beach. The uprising was the culmination of the city's reoccurring racial violence and the deteriorating social and economic conditions faced by blacks, but it also reflected growing racial tensions nationwide. The year 1919 saw over 20 race riots as black and white World War I veterans returned home to fierce job competition caused by inflation and rising unemployment rates. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Only a couple more items for this week in radical history. July 27, 1932. Army assaults encampment of over 20,000 World War I veterans who had camped in Washington asking Congress to speed up their bonus payments. The president orders current vets to break up the encampment of former vets. 2 were killed and hundreds wounded as the military fixed bayonets and cavalry charged across the veterans' encampment. Also on that date, 1953, Korean War ends. However, do we know when it started? Years before communists, quote, forces us into Korea, in 1887 the U.S. invaded to protect American interests. They would be forced out a month later. Again, seeing that everyone is equal under the law in 1957, Jimmy Wilson, a black farmhand from Alabama, is sentenced to death for stealing $1.95 from a white woman. Should have seen what had happened to him if he would have stole $2. One last item, 1974, the bill reads, on June 17, 1972, and prior thereto, agents of the Committee of the Re-election of President committed unlawful entry to the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee in Washington, District of Columbia, for purposes of securing political intelligence. Subsequent thereto, Richard M. Nixon, using the powers of his high office, engaged personally and through subordinates and agents in the course of conduct a plan designed to delay, impede, and obstruct the investigation of such unlawful entry, to cover up, conceal, and protect those responsible, and to conceal the existence and scope of their unlawful covert activities. Therefore, Richard M. Nixon, by such conduct, warrants impeachment and trial and removal from office. House Judiciary Committee votes 27-11, recommends Nixon's impeachment. Remember, it's the Nixon Doctrine and the Bush Doctrine that the executives have special privileges, and therefore anything they do is not considered illegal. Here's news, freedom banker invades Lewis Pike Field, inventing a new car for a new world. Do you value quality and comfort as well as agility and speed? This has been This Week in Radical History, produced out of the Glee Glee Studios. Special thanks to the WBAI Radio Roots crew material used in the show, the Slingshot Organizer, and the Daily Bleed website for all their great radical info. Special hello to another station airing this little ditty Wednesday nights on the program Rise Up on Radio Free Edmonton, CJSR, FM 88 in Alberta, Canada. Lastly, a reminder what anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman once said, if voting ever really changed anything, they would have made it illegal. Don't make her take out that horsewhip. And until next week, as always, I'm yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon. Blindfolded in my studio, my nigga the driver park with Elvis and Nicaragua. I'm in my studio, nigga up a tree at the office in my bedroom, on the underground, on the park with Elvis and Nicaragua. Blindfolded in my studio, here everything is perfect.
Give these people a voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice. Meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, "Joy, I voted."
You are listening to a radio. These radio waves are brought to you by quasars, pulsars, our sun, and some artificial sources.
But to say that John McCain was aligned with President Bush on the prosecution of the war in Iraq is to change history.
Are you proud of the work and the leadership of the Commander-in-Chief in this war?
Yes, I am. I think the President has led with great clarity, and I think he's done a great job leading the country.
Is it your view that Donald Rumsfeld can continue to be an effective Secretary of Defense?
Yes, today I do, and I believe he's done a fine job. He's an honorable man. We've got to stay the course, and speeches like the President's last night, I think, are important.
Choice is an illusion created between those with power and those without.
What do all men with power want? More power.
Now they knew who was master and leader. Sheep, thought I.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Remorse for what? You people have done everything in the world to me. Doesn't that give me equal right? I can do anything I want to you people at any time I want to, because that's what you've done to me. If you spit in my face and smack me in the mouth and throw me in solitary confinement for nothing, what do you think's going to happen when I get out of here? Well, I haven't done enough. I might be ashamed of that for not doing enough. For not doing enough. For not being more perceptive. For not being aware enough. For not being scared enough. For being stupid. Maybe I should have killed 400 or 500 people, then I would have felt better. Then I felt like I really offered society something. You've got it stuck in your brain that I must have done that. They would call me a murderer. I don't pretend to be a town or anything fancy. I can, but I find more real in the world that I'm in than I do the tinsel. And the real world is the one I have to deal with every day. Believe me, if I started murdering people, there could not be left.
Chemical weapons threat, terrorists, dangerous guy. In turn, murders.
There are some who feel like, the conditions are such that they can attack us there. My answer is bring them on.
homeless kids.
As of Monday, July 21st, 2008, 4,125 United States military personnel have died in Iraq since the start of the invasion.
We've got to stay the course, and we've got to stay the course, and we've got to stay the course, and stay the course, stay the course, stay the course.
Join us or die.
According to the British medical journal Lancet, over 100,000 Iraqi civilians had died since the start of the invasion.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
What do you see when you're in the dark and the demons come?
When they poured across the border, I was cautioned to surrender. This I could not do. I took my gun and vanished. I have changed my name so often. I've lost my wife and children, but I've many friends. And some of them are with me. An old woman gave us shelter, kept us hidden in the garret. Then the soldiers came. She died without a whisper. There were three of us this morning. I'm the only one this evening, but I must go on. The frontiers are my prison. Oh, the wind is blowing. Through the graves the wind is blowing. Freedom soon will come. Then we'll come from shadow.
Les amants étaient chez moi, ils me disent signe-toi, mais je n'ai pas peur. J'ai repris mon âme.
Radio commentator not addicted to illegal pain medication, nor Viagra, Mike Cannon.
The Mike Cannon Show, normally heard Mondays from 2 to 6.
My thanks to Mike Cannon at WNRB in Wausau, Wisconsin, who rebroadcast World Report.
Welcome to Media Minutes. Welcome to the weekly radio spin, a look at the stories behind the news, brought to you by the Center.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of cheap oil.
Women's E-News, weekly summary of news about women, women's issues, and from women's perspectives. From the weekly Cheers...
This week in radical history for the week of April 7th.
My name is Scooter, and this is the Inner Side radio program.
This week in Palestine, the service of the International Middle East Media Center. I am Ian...
Thanks for choosing This Way Out on WNRB, Wausau, Wisconsin.
All these programs and more can be heard each week on the Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio Show, normally heard every Monday from 2 to 6 p.m., right here on Central Wisconsin's only non-corporate, commercial-free community radio station, 93.3 WNRB LP, Wausau. Free people, free radio.
Thank you, thank you. And now the winner of the best Central Wisconsin community radio station as voted by us computer voices, WNRB. And now, the man your mother warned you about, Mike Cannon.